KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
RFK Jr. is firing all 17 members of the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee.
Why? And what could that mean for how vaccines are used in the U.S.?
Today is Tuesday, June 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. With a new pope in the Vatican, some women are pushing to become deacons.
The job has always been reserved for Catholic men.
I love preach. I really love it. I just want to preach.
Also this hour, amid immigration raids in L.A., we'll hear reaction from the San Fernando Valley, a hub of Latino immigrant life in this city.
Plus, the new thriller, Kill Your Darlings, tells the story of a murder and a marriage in reverse.
It was not an easy book to write. I think about halfway through, I almost quit because I was getting jumbled up. But I did keep going and kind of pull it together.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump is marking the 250th anniversary of the Army. Today, it was at a speech at Fort Bragg that quickly veered into the overtly political. NPR's Tamara Keith was traveling with the president.
Before a large crowd of uniformed soldiers, President Trump said the protests in Los Angeles were proof that uncontrolled migration leads to chaos and disorder, describing the nation's second largest city as a trash heap.
Generations of Army heroes did not shed their blood on distant shores only to watch our country be destroyed by invasion and third world lawlessness here at home, like is happening in California. As Commander-in-Chief, I will not let that happen.
Trump also decried protesters flying Mexican flags and said he wants Congress to pass a law to put anyone who burns an American flag in prison for a year. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The Trump administration is going back to court, fighting a previous ruling that more than 100 immigrants who were deported in March to El Salvador must be allowed to challenge their detentions. As NPR's Toby Smith reports, Trump says the federal district court order should be put on hold while he appeals to a higher court.
After Trump used the Alien Enemies Act to deport two plane loads of alleged Venezuelan gang members, U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg said that violated the men's due process rights. Then he ordered Trump to facilitate a way for them to get their due process now. But Trump argues he can't because the U.S. no longer has custody of the men, and he argues the lower court is overstepping its jurisdiction and intruding on the executive branch's authority to carry out foreign policy. Boasberg's ruling is one of several around the nation barring the administration from removing people under the 18th century law before they have a chance to contest their deportations in court. Jovia Smith, NPR News.
The Georgia Supreme Court has invalidated four of seven controversial state election board rules that sparked outcry when they passed before the 2024 election last year. At the time, the board's Republican majority drew praise from President Trump, who called them, quote, pit bulls fighting for victory. WABE Sam Greenglass reports from Atlanta.
The GOP election board said the changes were necessary to restore trust in elections. But local election officials worried the last-minute changes could create chaos in the critical battleground state. Now, the state's high court has unanimously found the board overstepped its authority. Among the rules struck down, two that could have resulted in local election board members refusing to certify results, and another that would have mandated hand-counting the total number of ballots. But some Georgia Republicans have pledged to bring the invalidated rules back to life by passing them in the legislature ahead of next year's midterms. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 105 points. The Nasdaq rose 123 points. This is NPR. Artificial intelligence applications are changing the face of many businesses. That apparently includes the spy business. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard telling an audience at a tech summit in Washington today her office has used AI to hasten the release of tens of thousands of pages of declassified material. Gabbard says once a human would have to read all the pages, but says AI can do it quickly and determine what still needs to stay classified. She said intelligent use of AI technology can free up agents to focus on intelligence gathering. Nearly a year after performers began a strike against video game companies, a tentative deal has been reached. NPR's Mandalito Bonker reports it still needs to be ratified by SAG-AFTRA members. And note that NPR News employees are union members, but under a different contract.
Last July, voiceover and body movement performers in the union went on strike against major video game companies such as Activision Productions, Disney Character Voices, Electronic Arts Productions, WB Games, and others. After a year of protests and negotiations, SAG-AFTRA leaders say they finally reached a tentative deal. They've not yet revealed details of the agreement other than to say it provides guardrails against the use of artificial intelligence. Performers on strike say they worry that their AI replicas could be used without consent or compensation, an issue the union characterizes as an existential threat to their work and livelihoods. The union's national board now needs to review the deal, and members need to vote on it before the strike is officially called off. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Oil fell 31 cents a barrel to $64.98 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. In an unprecedented move, Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is replacing all members of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP. It's a committee that plays a key role in setting CDC policies around vaccine schedules and access. The move set off alarm bells in the public health community. So we called Michael Osterholm to explain the potential impact on public health in the U.S. He's the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Welcome.
Thank you.
So first, just tell us real briefly here, what is the role of the ACIP? Like, how important is their work for people trying to make everyday health decisions or get access to vaccines?
Well, let me first just start out by explaining very briefly how vaccines actually come about. Mm-hmm. They first have to show that they're safe and effective, and that is a review that is done by the Food and Drug Administration. But before the actual agency takes on that decision, they actually have another group that they bring in called VRBPAC, which is like ACIP, but it addresses specifically safety and effectiveness. Then once it passes through there, it's moved to the CDC, to this committee called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, right, which includes 17 experts from around the country who have real expertise in understanding how should this vaccine be used, who's the groups that it should be recommended for and how. And that is a very, very important consideration, because how we pay for vaccines in this country is tied in large part, are they recommended or not? So for many people, if a vaccine's not recommended, even though we believe that they could benefit from it, they would very likely have to pay for that vaccine. And so this committee is very important.
Do you expect the CDC's vaccine recommendations will change because of these changes to that committee?
Well, one of the things that's happening right now is we are watching basically what I would consider to be over 60 years of good public health practice literally thrown out the window. And what I mean by that is that we have now, in a sense, eviscerated all of ACIP in terms of its expertise. Yesterday, all 17 members were basically fired from ACIP, and it's going to be repopulated by individual picks that Mr. Kennedy is going to make.
And we don't know those picks yet.
And we don't know who they are, but given his entire emphasis on reducing vaccine availability, it shouldn't be a surprise what we might hear about. And so this committee, which in the past has really been a wonderful example of the best of bringing science practice to public health policy, is now no longer there. And the criticisms that Mr. Kennedy used for deciding this, which by the way had never been done before in the history of the ACIP dating back more than 60 years.
You mean removing all 17 members?
Yes, losing all 17 members and have it being done by a individual who has no real expertise in vaccines. You know, he is a secretary that comes in as a lawyer, and his closest expertise to vaccines has been the mis- and disinformation campaigns.
He has accused the current members of the ACIP of having conflicts of interest. I think that's where you were going. Do you feel there is any merit to that claim?
No, there's no merit at all. And in fact, let me just be really clear. Dating back to 2000, when the first issue first came up about that, there was some issues raised about did some members have conflicts of interest. In 2009, an inspector general's report came out saying that there were problems with the process at CDC, but it turned out all of them were the papers weren't filled out correctly, the wrong dates or the wrong information was entered in the wrong place. Not one of those had anything to do with someone having a real conflict of interest. Since 2009, in fact, there has been no examples at all, zero, of someone having a conflict of interest where they all have to be disclosed. You can go to the CDC website right now and see all these members' disclosures. Okay. And in that case, they have to take the time that is devoted to a given topic that they have the conflict with, and they cannot participate during that time.
Ask you specifically about children here, because the CDC recommendations include guidelines for when adults and kids should receive vaccines for common illnesses. How might this move by Kennedy affect the vaccine schedule for infants and small children specifically, you think?
Well, right now, children would not be recommended for the primary series that, you know, after their birth, like we have had for the past several years. But let me just take a step back and say, when they talk about the vaccine in children and not necessary, this past winter, which was not considered part of the pandemic, the actual incidence of severe illness, hospitalizations, and deaths in children with COVID was similar to that was we saw with influenza. We recommend influenza vaccine. Why not recommend COVID vaccines, or at least give parents the option of that?
Michael Osterholm is the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
In these early weeks of Leo XIV's papacy, women who long to become Catholic deacons are hopeful. Now, according to the current rules of the Catholic Church, only men can be deacons. But as NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports, some women are pushing the Vatican to allow them to serve as well.
On the back wall of Dolores Mission in the Boyle Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles hangs a painting that depicts the assassination of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero.
And I remember me as a child crying and crying when I heard that he was killed.
Rosa Bonilla gestures to the image as she recalls her childhood in El Salvador.
My family and I just had just a little radio, and I remember my dad and my mom and my grandpa sitting around the table just listening what he said, and that helped me to do what I am doing right now.
What she's doing now, and has done for more than two decades at Dolores Mission, is serve as a pastoral assistant, visiting the sick, planning worship, praying with congregation members. It's a paid position, but one that has no official place within the Catholic Church. Now, a series of conversations that began years ago could soon change that.
There is no reason or impediment that should prevent women from carrying out leadership roles in the church. What comes from the Holy Spirit cannot be stopped.
Ellie Hidalgo is reading from a Vatican document approved late last year at a meeting in which Pope Leo participated.
And then it goes on to say, the question of women's access to diaconal ministry remains open. This discernment needs to continue.
Hidalgo is co-director of Discerning Deacons, an organization that works to allow for women to serve as deacons.
My hope is that Pope Leo has every intention of shepherding this teaching forward, and that we get to have many additional conversations about women's participation in the church.
Women had served as deacons in the early church, but Catholics now restrict that ministry to only men. Pope Leo has been noncommittal to opening the diaconate to women, citing the church's very significant and long tradition of male-only clergy. But Hidalgo says women aspiring to be deacons are ready to work with the new pope to make their hope a reality. It's work that Jasmine Jimenez is ready to do. Here she is giving a homily last year during the Feast of St. Phoebe, a woman referred to as a deacon in the New Testament, in Paul's letter to the Romans.
The good news for us today is that the Holy Spirit has the ability to transform our discomfort into a quiet confidence.
Jimenez directs liturgy and worship at American Martyrs Catholic Church in Manhattan Beach, California.
I am somebody who is providing space to break open the word, to celebrate sacraments, and to be of service to the community.
And over the years, Jimenez came to hear the call of the Holy Spirit.
And I thought, wow, something is stirring here, and I want to continue to pay attention to that and what female deacons might look like for the Catholic Church.
For Jimenez, it's about more than simply the title deacon.
There's a sacramental grace that comes along with ordination to the diaconate. And some days are easy and joyful, and other days are really hard. And to receive that grace and to have it sustain me in the work that I do would make a big difference.
Jimenez believes Pope Leo will recognize that grace is available to women too because of his experiences.
As an American, to know that when he studied theology, there were women in his classroom, right? Because here there are men and women who get to study together, so that he has a lived experience of being partners in ministry with lay and religious women in our ongoing discernment.
It's discernment that the Vatican is also doing. Pope Francis asked a group of theologians there to study the issue. In fact, Jasmine Jimenez and Rosa Bonilla are two of 29 women from around the world who this year submitted to the Vatican testimonies about their calling.
Nuestra Señora del Camino.
Back at Mission Dolores, Rosa Bonilla points to a mural just beside the altar, Our Lady of the Way.
When our community or our people from El Salvador was coming from here in the 80s to see how Mary walked with us in the road, in our ways, from the village to the city.
The image of Mary walking from war-torn El Salvador to the promise of the U.S. reflects Bonilla's own journey, a journey she wants to continue, discerning a call to become a deacon of her church.
My hope for Pop Leo, that he continue todos, all, women and men. I have been praying for that.
Praying and working to become a deacon, Bonilla says, as a smile lights up her face.
I love preach. I really love it. I just want to preach. For me, to have this title is to feel more liberty to speak.
Speak words of grace and truth, just like her inspiration Oscar Romero did, to a community longing for good news. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The basics of a whodunit are just that. You are trying to unravel the who, what, when, and where of a dastardly crime. Well, Peter Swanson's new thriller, Kill Your Darlings, turns all that on its head. You know who the killer is from the first pages. You spend the rest of the book trying to figure out why.
It was not an easy book to write. I think about halfway through, I almost quit because I was getting jumbled up thinking about it, but I did keep going and kind of pull it together.
Swanson told me how he pulled it together, starting with the who. The main characters, Tom and Wendy Graves, married, in their 50s, both writers, living on the North Shore of Massachusetts.
On the outside, they'd be an upper middle class, look quite happy. But inside the house, their marriage is definitely falling apart. Tom is drunk most of the time and seemingly guilty. Wendy is concerned about Tom and what he might give away about their lives. And in fact, she's so concerned that, as we learn very early in the beginning of the novel, she's thinking it might be a good idea to kill him.
Yeah. Read us the bit where Wendy makes up her mind. It's not just a good idea to kill him, but she might actually do it. And just to set the scene a little bit, they have just thrown a dinner party for colleagues, and Tom has once again had way too much to drink.
She could see it in his blank eyes and the way his mouth was slightly ajar, lower lip hanging. She took a tiny sip of her wine. He had put his empty glass down and was mimicking playing the piano along with Imad Jamal. God, she despised him. She'd also known that he was never going to change, but she hadn't admitted to herself yet that she truly hated him. I should just kill him, she thought. What are you smiling about? Tom said. Just murder, she said back. Your murder. He laughed and moved his hands along the imaginary keys.
I hate to laugh, but it's so, I mean, there's no doubt she's about to do it, and she does, and I will say the where of this murder mystery is the famous exorcist steps, famous from the movie The Exorcist, in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. Describe them and describe what happens there.
Well, my first trip to Washington, D.C., unlike most people who want to see all the monuments, the first thing I wanted to see was the exorcist steps. You know, those are the steps that Father Karras tumbles down to his death. So that was my first tourist stop in D.C., and I'd always remembered them. They are genuinely very long and quite steep and quite deadly. I think nowadays they're being used as an exercise facility. People run up and down them.
I run up and down them. I will inject. I live around the corner.
Oh, you do.
And those steps have nearly killed me more than once. Not because anybody pushed me, but because they are extraordinarily long and steep. Yes.
And again, we're at the very beginning of the book, and we know that Wendy's thinking of how to kill her husband, and she's already kind of tried to kill him by pushing him down the stairs in their house, which isn't long enough, so she thinks, I'm going to need a longer set of steps.
You can see all the pieces coming together. Then, though, the reason that we don't give up reading after the first chapter is you do something fascinating, which is tell the whole story, their whole marriage, in reverse. So the book is moving backward in time, from when Wendy pushes Tom down the steps, that's 2023, all the way back to 1982.
Right.
Why? Why tell it that way?
Well, I mean, the genesis of this book was really two ideas coming together. And one was the desire to write a book in reverse. I mean, I had thought about this as someone who loves crime novels, is that they often do go a little bit in reverse in the sense that we start with a corpse, and by the end of the book, we know what happened before that corpse arrived. I thought, what if we could just really literalize that and have a story go entirely in reverse, so that we slowly learn the events that led to the version of Tom and Wendy, that unhappy version of them in their 50s. And then the other thing that really got me into the story was this idea of a young couple that plot to kill. In those stories that we're familiar with, it doesn't go well. But what if it did? What if this young couple got away with it and then lived happily ever after? What would they be like 30 years down the line? And those two ideas came together and created this book.
Peter Swenson, you are a writer, obviously. We're talking to you about your book. You're writing here about characters who are both writers. Tom is an academic and has tenure at a university and keeps trying to write the great American novel. Wendy is a published poet. Did you relate to either of them as a fellow writer?
Yeah, I think, especially Wendy, because I began my writing career as an aspiring poet. That was all through my 20s. I was really solely writing poetry, unlike Tom, where he has this vision of being a great novelist. I think Wendy's kind of she's blasé about the whole thing. I mean, it doesn't mean as much to her ego as it does to Tom, who I think feels like he can salvage some of his life by becoming this great writer, and it's tied up in his ego.
I was laughing because you show us many of Tom's awful first drafts, which he abandons after like three paragraphs, and then he goes back and reads them and feels even worse.
Yeah,
I thought only another writer could have come up with that because it's so true.
Yeah, I think he has one point where he's written a few paragraphs and then he's just written awful, 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 awful underneath it. There's shame attached to him in writing, and I think I felt a little bit of that. I used to not tell people I was a writer because it felt, I don't know, like you're trying to, like you have something to say to the world is a little embarrassing.
It felt pretentious or something?
I don't know. I think a lot of writers don't feel this way and are happy to shout it to the world, but there's two types of writers. So he lives with a lot of shame, some for good reason.
So it struck me, Peter Swenson, the thing that has bound these two characters, Wendy and Tom, for decades is a shared secret that they need to keep. And the thing that ultimately breaks them, both as individuals and as a couple, is that they each have a huge secret, or two, that they do not share, that they're carrying all by themselves.
Right.
What's the lesson there?
One lesson is, don't live your life like Tom and Wendy. But when we meet them as young lovers, they're very much like a lot of us, like we'll never lie to one another. We're in this together. This is our lives, our shared lives. But as things progress, and it happens pretty fast that they start to hide things from one another. You know, it does make you wonder if along the way they had remained completely open, if maybe they'd have existed longer. Everyone deals with guilt to a certain degree, and we all deal with it in slightly different ways. And I think that's one of the major themes of this book.
Peter Swenson telling us about his new book, Kill Your Darlings. Peter Swenson, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary Louise.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Trump has mobilized the National Guard and the Marines following days of protests against immigration raids in Los Angeles, despite objections from California's governor. We'll speak with an official from the Department of Homeland Security about why the Trump administration says a military presence is necessary to restore order. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. Coming up, new hope in the fight against fentanyl.
Including a stunning drop in overdose deaths among younger Americans.
I think we are making progress. Mortality among, say, college-age people has gone down faster than the rest of the population.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The mayor of Los Angeles is pushing back on the need for National Guard troops and active duty military to control immigration protests here in the nation's second largest city. The Trump administration says the troops are needed to restore order, but local officials say the protests, for the most part, have been manageable with their own law enforcement resources. Tricia McLaughlin with the Department of Homeland Security defends the president's actions to use the military in L.A.
We saw on Friday about 1,000 protesters were surrounding ICE enforcement in a federal building, far outnumbering them. And then we saw that again on Sunday, about 6,000 protesters, again, vastly outnumbering our ICE enforcement officers. So this is really just greater resources.
Protesters have been demonstrating against the administration's ICE raids throughout the city. The mayor and LA's police chief are meeting to discuss a possible curfew tonight around the downtown area. NASA has suspended several social media accounts tied to some of its most popular space missions. NPR's Jeff Brumfield tells us the shutdowns come amid deeper cuts at the agency.
Roughly 2 dozen accounts on the social media platform X appear to have been suspended, including those for NASA's two Mars rovers and the agency's long-running Voyager spacecraft. Those three accounts alone have millions of followers, but are being archived in an effort to, quote, streamline communications, according to an identical post put up across the affected accounts. The suspensions come a day after NASA said it was continuing to shrink its staff through voluntary separations and early retirements. The Trump administration has called for deep cuts to the space agency in next year's budget. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Stocks finished modestly higher on Wall Street today as a second day of trade talks between China and the U.S. continued. This is NPR. Israel has deported climate activist Greta Thunberg after she and 11 other protesters were stopped at sea trying to bring food and aid to Gaza. The 22-year-old Swedish national was put on a flight out of the country today. Here's NPR's Carrie Kahn.
Israel's foreign ministry posted pictures of Thunberg on a flight to Sweden via France. Thunberg and the other activists, including a member of the European Union Parliament, tried to reach Gaza but were boarded by the Israeli Navy early Monday. The group sought to bring attention to the plight of Palestinians in Gaza, with at least 55,000 killed in the more than 610 days of the war, according to health officials there. Hunger is widespread, and UN officials warn of impending famine. Four protesters agreed to voluntarily departures, but many others refused. Israel's defense minister called the group anti-Semitic and that Israel will, quote, act against any attempt to break its blockade and assist terrorist groups by sea, by air, and by land. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Here in Los Angeles, the BET Awards 25th anniversary show last night delivered some major star power and a mix of comedy, emotion, and calls for justice. Some of the artists drew attention to the immigration raids and protests taking place just miles from the Peacock Theater here in L.A. Mariah Carey, Snoop Dogg, and Jamie Foxx received the Ultimate Icon Award. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Amid ongoing ICE raids around here in Los Angeles, many immigrant communities are fearful about living their daily lives, like leaving their homes, showing up to work, shopping at local businesses. Freelance journalist Benjamin Gottlieb spent some time in the San Fernando Valley, one of the many hubs of Latino immigrant life in this city. He talked to residents, business owners, and workers, and joins us now to tell us more about how all these recent raids are affecting people and changing their routines. Hi, Benjamin.
How's it going?
Good. Well, I understand that you spoke with dozens of people who live in this area and who are here without legal status, right? What are they telling you?
Yeah, they're telling me they are incredibly afraid. And also, there's this growing sense of helplessness. I mean, so many folks are just staying home. When I was out reporting, I saw an unusually low number of people milling about, especially on Van Nuys Boulevard, which is this major street in this part of Los Angeles. It felt like a ghost town, really. I spoke with about a dozen day laborers and street vendors. Many were happy to chat, but fearful, recorded, or to give any identifying information. One person who was willing to be recorded asked me not to use his name because he's here without documentation and he has U.S.-born children. He's afraid of being separated from them or of all of them being deported. He and his wife, Sel, cut fruits out of the family pickup truck. She grills hot dogs and vegetables on a makeshift stove, and they work out of a Home Depot parking lot. Many of their clients are day laborers and shoppers, and several ICE raids have taken place around Home Depot, so they're very scared. Take a listen. Honestly, it's worrying, he says. My wife and I are really shaken. Sometimes we are trying to decide whether to go out and buy inventory or not. We're unsure. You know, he also told me that he has no choice but to work. This is the only way he supports his family. And both he and his wife are just worried they're putting themselves at risk by doing this.
Right. Well, what did people tell you about what they are worrying about the most right now?
Yeah, so it's not just the fact that there are ICE raids. Those happen in Los Angeles. But immigration advocates say more people are being deported in an expedited way. So they might get put on a plane before they have a chance to appeal to an immigration judge. One person I spoke with who also did not want to be named out of fear of deportation says he came to the U.S. 3 years ago from Cuba. His lawyer says he has a work permit and a pending asylum case, but he's afraid to go to work. Go to court because he's scared he could get swept up in one of these raids and deported immediately. And, you know, it's really important to note, immigrants without legal status are ubiquitous in Los Angeles. This is the largest county in the U.S., about 10 million people. Census data puts the immigrant population at about a third. And there are estimates that as many as 1 million people in L.A. County are in the country illegally. So these are our neighbors, employees, workers. There's lots of mixed status families here.
Could you very briefly tell us what business owners are telling you, people who rely on some of these people for their businesses?
That's right. I walked into a juice bar that Jonathan Reyes and his family owns in Van Nuys. He says people no longer feel safe to go out and they're just not coming to buy juice.
Afectó en muchas formas porque ya no, la gente ya no se siente confiada a salir a las calles.
He says he's seen a 70% drop in business in just the last few months since the Trump administration began upping immigration enforcement. And he also told me that he had to throw away about $600 worth of product on Saturday because it all went bad. All businesses need to plan, he said, and that's just impossible to do right now.
That is Benjamin Gottlieb. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Drug overdose deaths have fallen dramatically in the United States. New federal data show young people under the age of 35 are seeing some of the biggest improvements. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann has been tracking this promising shift in America's overdose crisis. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ari.
Let's begin by looking back at how fentanyl affected young people and their families. Why was this drug epidemic different?
Well, first, it was just starkly and is still starkly more deadly. It reached also into every corner of society. Covering this crisis over the last 5 years, I've met so many people devastated by fentanyl, One of the young people I spent time with was Ryan Barnett, a guy in his 20s in Oklahoma who is now in recovery from fentanyl. Sitting at his kitchen table in 2023, he told me he feels lucky to be alive.
I did take a big chunk of my life and threw it in the trash. You know, you lose your best friends in this whole thing. If they're alive, they're in prison for the most part.
And I've heard this over and over, Ari, fentanyl was so lethal. It forced families to think differently about drugs. You know, drug experimentation has been part of American culture for decades, risky, but in the past, usually not deadly. But after drug dealers started mixing fentanyl into cocaine and into fake prescription pills and other drugs, young people were just incredibly vulnerable. Over the last decade alone, more than 230,000 people in the U.S. under the age of 35 have died from drug overdoses.
Which makes this reversal so dramatic. How big is the shift?
Yeah, this really is the first moment of hope for many families since fentanyl hit. The deaths just seemed unstoppable. But in 2023, the number of deaths among teens and 20-somethings finally started edging down. And then last year, they really plunged, with some young people seeing a 47% decline in deaths. Ed Turnin is co-founder of a fentanyl awareness group called Song for Charlie. In 2020, his own son, a college student, was killed by the drug. Here's what he had to say.
I think we are making progress. Mortality among, say, college age people, 20 to 24, has gone down faster than the rest of the population.
Deaths are also declining among teens, although slower. There is significant progress there too. In all, we're seeing about 15,000 fewer deaths per year among people under the age of 35. That's last year compared with the peak of the crisis.
And do researchers think fentanyl deaths will keep coming down?
This part's really cool. There are some signs that this trend could be solid and could push forward. Navarone Desgupta is an addiction policy researcher at the University of North Carolina. He's been looking at real-time overdose reports collected in just the last few months in cities and rural counties around the U.S. He found that drug deaths for young people appear to still be dropping.
From these fast-reporting jurisdictions, I see that the trend continuing and accentuating.
So we've now seen two straight years of improvement in drug deaths for young people. Now we're at the lowest level since 2013.
Big positive shifts like this don't usually happen with street drugs. Do drug policy experts know what is helping young people survive?
Yeah, some families and activists I've been talking to believe teens and 20-somethings are finally getting the message that drug experimentation is just a lot riskier now. There's also a lot more Narcan, also known as naloxone, being distributed. That's the medication that reverses fentanyl overdoses. And there's also just less fentanyl getting into American communities now. The supply has been disrupted, and that could mean fewer kids exposed.
These improvements came during the last 2 years of the Biden administration, and now President Trump is in office. Is the national response to fentanyl changing?
Yeah, the Biden team invested a massive amount of federal money in the fentanyl fight. The Republican budget passed by the House with President Trump's support would cut billions of dollars from those programs. The Congressional Budget Office says a lot of low-income Americans will likely lose insurance coverage that often goes for addiction care. The Health and Human Services Department sent a statement to NPR saying the goal is to streamline resources and eliminate redundancies. But a lot of family members, doctors, and researchers I talked to were worried that important programs could be cut and this dramatic recovery for people under 35 could stall.
That's NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
This is NPR News. The U.S. and Iran have been holding meetings over the past few months to try to hammer out a nuclear agreement. At times, President Trump has announced that a deal is close. Other times, it seems the talks could fall apart and that he could unleash airstrikes. Despite the high stakes, as NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports, some Iranians are greeting the news with a shrug.
In 2015, when the nuclear deal between Iran, the U.S., and other world powers was signed, Zahra was in her mid-20s. The unemployed fashion designer from the northwestern Iranian city of Hamedan remembers the excitement at the time about Iran's future. She says she remembers a sense of hope and belief back then. The nuclear deal placed stringent restrictions on Iran's nuclear program in exchange for an end to crippling sanctions on the country. Zahra, like all the other people who spoke to NPR for this report, asked that her full name not be used out of fear of retribution from Iran's hardline government. She said back then people believed the leadership wanted to better Iran. She says she believed things would become normal and saw it as an opportunity to connect to the world. Instead, the Iranian regime continued to be corrupt and cracked down on dissent. Trump pulled out of that deal during his first term. Now he wants a new, very similar deal. Zahra doesn't think anything will change if there's another nuclear agreement. That sense of resignation is widespread, says Davoud, a 45-year-old architect who runs construction projects in Mashhad, in northeast Iran.
I don't see or hear people talking about the nuclear negotiations. Most people aren't following it. There's a huge indifference among people.
But Davoud says there are jokes about the Iranian leaders' handling of the nuclear talks, including one about the vitamin B2.
People say if B2 vitamin had been used earlier, the Iranian leadership would have been controlled earlier. They mean B2 bombers.
30-year-old Nagar, an English teacher in Tehran, says it's no surprise Iranians are making jokes about the nuclear negotiations with the Trump administration.
I don't really think either side knows exactly what they're doing. I think they're forced into these negotiations out of desperation.
Trump says, unlike the first deal, he doesn't want Iran to be able to enrich uranium. Tehran says it has the right to enrich small amounts to run power plants and the like. Nagar says Trump likely thinks Iran is vulnerable. Its economy is in shambles and has been militarily weakened by Israel. Trump has warned he will back military action if Iran won't agree to a deal. Nagar thinks that's a bluff.
I don't think Trump will really take military action or give Israel the green light to do this, because he has always touted the idea of non-interference and reducing American interference in the rest of the world.
Nagar says the Iranian government has probably reached a similar conclusion and doesn't take Trump's threats seriously. She says that's why they keep stalling and prolonging the talks. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Storms and floods have always been a fact of life for people living along the coasts. But climate change is raising the risk, making extreme rain more common, supercharging storms. In places like coastal New Jersey, sea levels are rising, land is sinking. As part of NPR's Climate Solutions Week, WHYY, Sophia Schmidt takes us to one New Jersey town where people are adapting by raising their homes off the ground.
Amanda DeVecker-Rainier lives about as close to the water as you can get.
We are quite literally right on the bay, so the bay is part of my yard.
She lives on Cedar Bonnet Island in Stafford Township, New Jersey. The house has been in her family for generations.
That is the bay beach where I used to play when I was a kid and where we take my daughter now.
These days, her gray shingled house sits on wooden stilts, high enough to park a car underneath. But it wasn't always like that. For decades, the house sat on cinder blocks, just three steps up to the door. In 2012, Hurricane Sandy slammed into the Jersey Shore. The water rose high enough to threaten the homes in DeVecker-Rainier's neighborhood, including her dad's.
The last picture he sent me was from our neighbor, Mike, who lived behind the house at that point in time, and the water was up to the door.
Her dad's house was damaged so badly, it had to be torn down. But DeVecker-Rainier's house survived. It happened to be lifted for construction, so it didn't flood. It felt unbelievably lucky, she says.
Like, what are the chances that it was up in the air when Sandy hit, you know? Like, it just feels like there's, like, a lot of family that's, like, still here in these walls and that they're kind of looking out.
The storm damaged or destroyed tens of thousands of homes across the state. Lisa Auermuller directs a coastal research initiative at Rutgers University. She says Sandy was a wake-up call for New Jersey.
I really think there was a new recognition of how entirely vulnerable we are to a storm creating so much impact.
After the storm, some shore towns doubled down on building and reinforcing sand dunes. In other towns, families took voluntary buyouts offered by the state. But Stafford Township has no dunes, and residents like DeVecker-Rainier don't want to leave. So the town has focused on elevating homes. Lifting homes is not a silver bullet, though. Chad Berginnis directs the Association of State Floodplain Managers. He says the safest thing is not to build in flood zones at all, but elevation can be a practical alternative.
We have millions of homes at risk in floodplains in the country. And home elevation, I think, is one of those techniques that you're going to see used more and more as our nation faces increasing losses from flooding.
Many property owners rebuilding homes that were heavily damaged by Sandy didn't have a choice. They had to raise their homes to meet newer standards in flood zones. DeVecker-Rainier's house didn't trigger those requirements. But to her, going up was the obvious thing to do.
I mean, my whole neighborhood got trashed. I mean, it was like a, you know, like an act of God that this house didn't, and I wasn't going to take that for granted, right? Like, I mean, obviously, talk about scared straight.
But raising a house is expensive, over $140,000 for DeVecker-Rainier. Her town received some federal funding to help property owners elevate, but it only covered a dozen households. That grant paid for most of DeVecker-Rainier's costs, but she had to front the money. So she took a loan out from family.
We're still paying it down, so it was within reach for us, but that would not have been true for every person and every family.
After Sandy, assistance was slow to reach many households. Some people couldn't afford to rebuild. Now, DeVecker-Rainier leads a nonprofit that advocates for storm survivors. She says more funding needs to be available to help families elevate both before and after disasters. And grants need to reach disaster survivors faster.
I will do everything I can to, like, continue to make sure that, like, regular people and working families like mine don't end up on the losing end of this.
She hopes if another storm like Sandy hits New Jersey, more families can afford to stay, like she did. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Schmidt in Stafford Township, New Jersey.
Climate Solutions Week continues tomorrow here on All Things Considered when we hear how some homeowners are saving on their insurance premiums. You can find the whole series at npr.org/climateweek.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week Rethinking Home comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today, we wanted to bring you a story to celebrate Father's Day. It's told by Darren Wayman. In 2019, Darren's wife gave birth to a baby boy they named Hudson.
He was my first child, and I was absolutely terrified of being a father. It was the biggest barrier to me having kids because I didn't know if I was capable of being a good dad. My wife was so sure about having kids. She seemed so ready and confident, and I had no doubt that she would be a great mother, which made me question myself even more. There's so many books out there telling you how to parent, particularly how to not ruin your child through their upbringing. A lot of parents are happy to share their parenting horror stories or tips that worked for their kids that they assume will work for everyone else's kids, when maybe that's not always the case. When my son was born, I was standing in that delivery room. My mind was on overload with all this information, trying to get it right, trying to straighten it out in my brain. I must have been standing in that delivery room staring at my newborn son and wife with a glazed look on my face, because the moment had come and I still felt as unprepared as ever. The room was a rotating door of nurses and doctors coming and going, when at one point a male doctor, he came into the room. He must have seen the deer in the headlights look on my face. He stood alongside me, you know, oriented the same way that I was facing my son. And he finally said, "Just make sure he's fed, clean, warm, and loved. And the rest will take care of itself." The moment that he simplified parenting for me into four basic objectives, it was like an enormous weight had been lifted off my shoulders. He helped remove the mental clutter and gave me direction. I now have two kids, and it's been 5 years since that doctor said those words to me. Throughout those 5 years, anytime I'm struggling as a parent, I often think back to those words as my parenting foundation. I make sure my kids are fed, clean, warm, and loved. And the rest really has taken care of itself. To my unsung hero, thank you for your words of comfort. Thank you for going beyond the call of duty to help a new and overwhelmed father simplify how to care for his kids.
Darren Wayman lives in Southwest Colorado. His son Hudson is now 6 years old, and his daughter Hattie is two. Hudson loves to read and play soccer. His sister is already planning on going into medicine and can often be found walking around wearing a doctor's coat. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Total Wine & More, for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From EBSCO, committed to providing perpetual access to print and digital books for libraries and the communities they serve. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Skoll Foundation.
Us on the bus, riding on for hours through the power. When the passengers make room, whisper bride and groom, that's us. On a bus, two in one seat, love on every detour. You can be sure that I'll show you how it feels to honeymoon on wheels with two in one seat. Slow down, Route 27 is the nearest thing to heaven I know. Speed up, start hitting 60 and my heart will jump and thump. Oh, oh, what a bum. Us on a bus, kisses intimating that we're waiting till it's time to light the lamps. Hit the tourist camps, that's us on a bus, yeah.